First of time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting a deadline on Iran nuclear negotiations has been extended. International negotiations on Iran's nuclear program have been extended a week to July 7th after the self-imposed deadline to reach a comprehensive deal by June 30th came and went. At the White House Tuesday, President Obama cautioned the U.S. would walk away from a nuclear deal with Iran if he's not convinced it would block Tehran's path to building a nuclear weapon.
There has been a lot of talk on the other side from the Iranian negotiators about whether, in fact, they can abide by some of the terms that came up in Luzon. If they cannot, that's going to be a problem, because I've said from the start, I will walk away from the negotiations if, in fact, it's a bad deal.
The talks in Vienna are believed to hinge on the scope of international inspections and the timing of the lifting of sanctions hurting Iran's economy. Meanwhile, the UN Atomic Energy Watchdog, the International Atomic Energy Agency, is reportedly set to announce that Iran has complied with a preliminary deal requiring a reduction in its stockpile of low-enriched uranium. Liberia Tuesday announced the return of the deadly Ebola virus weeks after the West African country was declared Ebola-free with a positive test on a body of a teenager, the first confirmed case since May 9th. Bernice Dawn, the country's health minister, says the 17-year-old died June 24 and was safely buried after the body was swabbed for testing purposes.
The sample was sent out for testing. It was sent to the laboratory for testing. On receipt of this positive result, the incident management system activated a team to conduct a detailed investigation in the area.
More than 11,000 have died of Ebola across West Africa in the past 18 months. This is VOA News. Indonesian officials say more than 140 perished when a military transport plane crashed into a residential neighborhood on the island of Sumatra Tuesday. There were 122 people on board the ill-fated Hercules C-130, which slammed into a hotel and two homes in Medan shortly after takeoff. The plane was attempting to return to the airport, reportedly with engine trouble. Greece is officially in default after missing a $1.8 billion loan repayment to the International Monetary Fund. European finance ministers decided Tuesday against extending a bailout program which would have enabled Athens to meet its obligations. The ministers plan to hold more talks Wednesday. Greek businessmen hope for a quick solution. Konstantinos Mikalos is head of the Athens Chamber of Commerce.
We are losing 59 businesses per day. 600 jobs are being lost as a result of this economic policy, and therefore we need to find an alternative solution.
Greece's next hope would be for the IMF to agree to a Greek request to extend the ban. Tunisian officials say the gunman who killed 38 at a Tunisian hotel beach resort last week was trained at a jihadist camp in Libya last year. The officials told Western media the gunman, Saif Rezgui, trained in Libya at the same time as two other Tunisian gunmen who killed more than 20 at the Bardo Museum in Tunis back in March. The Islamic State group claimed responsibility for both. British Foreign Secretary Philip Hammond acknowledges the IS group poses a significant security challenge.
I think the thing that's changed is the spread of ISIL into the ungoverned territory of Libya, a neighboring country to Tunisia. As ISIL has spread across Libya, it has posed a threat not just to us, but to the neighboring countries, which sadly we've seen realized in this attack in Tunisia.
Many of those killed near Sousse were British nationals. Others were from Germany, Ireland, Belgium, and Portugal. Dozens were wounded. The UN says another 10,000 Burundians fled the country last weekend ahead of Monday's controversial parliamentary election. Since the country's turmoil began with the decision by President Pierre Nkurunziza to seek a third term, more than 140,000 are believed to have fled Burundi for neighboring countries, including Tanzania, Uganda, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and Rwanda. Burundi holds a presidential poll on July 15th. Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi has vowed to strengthen anti-terror laws and blamed the country's outlawed Muslim Brotherhood for Monday's assassination of the country's top prosecutor. He spoke Tuesday at the funeral of Hisham Barakat, who oversaw the cases against thousands of Islamists. The French Defense Ministry says two soldiers have been suspended over child abuse allegations in Burkina Faso. They're part of a French force of more than 200 involved in anti-terror operations. Similar allegations have been approached against several French soldiers in Central African Republic.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
We'll be right back.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, the first day of July, and here are some of the stories we are covering. The UN accuses South Sudan's army of widespread human rights abuses.
We call upon the government to fully investigate these serious allegations of misconduct by members of its own army as well as associated armed groups.
Joseph Contreras is head of public information for the United Nations mission in South Sudan. Victims of former Chadian President Issen Habre look forward to confronting him when his trial starts later this month. Ebola returns to Liberia with the death of a teenager, and political tension in Uganda after a challenger to President Museveni is banned from holding meetings.
Museveni has always known this method of taking down his opponents with a lot of force, because opponents in Ugandan politics come out so often that you identify and attack you and finish you.
Amos Desmond Wambi is a Ugandan media consultant. The United States, Britain, and Sweden give Zimbabwe $8 million to improve the economic prospects of young Zimbabweans. And a blind Somali journalist defies all odds to work in Mogadishu. Those stories plus Mark Oldman Sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The United Nations mission in South Sudan, known as OMIS, says that civilians in Unity State have again been the targets of extreme violence. In a report released Tuesday, the UN said women and girls were raped and brutally killed, villagers were abducted, and tens of thousands forced from their homes during last April's upsurge in violence. The UN blames South Sudan's army and its allied militias and calls for the alleged perpetrators to be brought to justice. Charlton Doki of VOA South Sudan in Focus program reports from Juba.
This is not the first time the UN has accused the South Sudan army of human rights abuses in the 19-month-old conflict. But UNMISS says this time around, the scope and level of cruelty are far greater, suggesting that the violence is driven by something other than political differences. Joseph Contreras, head of public information at UNMISS, says victims and eyewitnesses from Unity State's Rubkona, Gwit, Koch, Ler and Mayom counties were interviewed for the report.
Investigators established that at least 67 civilians were killed during the upsurge in fighting in Unity State that began in late April. They also documented about 172 women and girls who had been abducted. An additional 79 women and girls were subjected to sexual violence, including gang rape. Also, our personnel found that in at least 9 separate incidents, women and girls were burnt alive in tukuls after they were gang raped in Koch County and elsewhere.
UNMISS says survivors of the attacks told investigators that the SPLA and allied militias from Mayom County were behind the violence. The survivors say the assailants killed civilians, looted and destroyed villages, and displaced more than 100,000 people. UNMISS says that in some instances, UN investigators were unable to access sites where the alleged attacks occurred. In some cases, the investigators were barred by the SPLA from accessing the sites, and in other cases, logistical challenges prevented them from conducting a probe. Contreras says the United Nations will continue to monitor and investigate human rights abuses against civilians. He says the authorities in Juba must conduct their own investigations.
We call upon the government to fully investigate these serious allegations of misconduct by members of its own army as well as associated armed groups who worked with SPLA units during this recent offensive. These perpetrators must be held accountable in order to break the cycle of impunity that allows such violence to continue.
Contreras says UNMISS provided advance copies of the report to South Sudan's Foreign Ministry, the SPLA, and rebel representatives. But he says neither the government nor the rebels have commented on the report's findings. SPLA spokesman Colonel Philip Aguirre and Defense Minister Kuol Manyang did not answer repeated calls seeking comment on the report. For VOA News, I am Charlton Doki in Juba.
Victims of former Chadian President Issa Hayble say they look forward to confronting him when his trial starts later this month in Senegal's capital, Dakar. The 72-year-old Hayble has been in custody in Senegal since his arrest in June 2013. He is accused of torture, war crimes, and crimes against humanity. This week, lawyers said they had compiled a list of 4,000 victims to testify at the trial. Clement Abai Futa is president of the Association of Victims of the Crimes of the Regime of Issa Hayble. He says he spent 4 years in prison under Mr. Hayble and wants to know from him why. Abai Futa also said he wants to restore his dignity as a human being that was taken away from him.
You know, we are looking for the trial because he suffered. He was arrested without reason. And it is right for us to know why we were arrested. So I think it is a great opportunity for us to know what happened under his reign.
Have you been able to identify other witnesses besides yourself?
Yes. You know, I spent about 4 years in the prison, so I suffer a lot. And I'm witness of what happened in the many prison and where I was arrested or where I was in the prison. I was in the prison.
You are still in Chad. What is the human rights situation now in Chad?
Let's say that in Chad, the situation of human rights is not very, very quite good because they are playing such a game that I don't know. So they are not respected all the right, all the engagement of our country. So it's not very good and it's not democratically.
As a victim, what would you want? What do you want from the former Chadian president? Do you want money or what?
First of all, I want the trial of this dictatorial last president. I want, first of all, the trial. And secondly, I want or I wish to be rescued in my dignity.
Your dignity?
Yes.
And you feel that the former Chadian president took away your dignity or what?
Yes. Throughout 4 years, my dignity did not exist because I was arrested without accommodation, without news of my family. So I didn't exist. So my dignity broke.
There's been this argument whether the former Chadian president should have been taken to the International Criminal Court. Are you satisfied with the trial being held in Senegal?
I wish it, and we battle about it. We work hard throughout 25 years, and I think that it is a main goal for us to Senabre to be judged in the Senegal in the International Court.
When is the trial supposed to come on? When?
20 July.
Clement Abai Futa is the president of the Association of Victims of the Crimes of the Regime of Issa Hayble. He was speaking with me from Chad's capital, N'Djamena. Political tension in Uganda's capital, Kampala, is on the rise after the Inspector General of Police banned any public meetings by presidential hopeful and former Prime Minister Amama Mbabazi, saying he does not have the legitimate backing of the ruling National Resistance Movement Party. It is the latest salvo in a political battle by Mr. Mbabazi to challenge President Yoweri Museveni's long rule. Lisbeth Pollard has more from Kampala.
One-time presidential ally, Amama Mbabazi, appears to have the government concerned enough to ban him from holding any public meetings. But that's not all. On Sunday afternoon, soldiers and police lined the road from Kampala to Entebbe International Airport, citing an ambiguous security threat. But locals say the show of force was aimed at sending a message to Mr. Mbabazi, who was due to arrive in Uganda from abroad. Media consultant Amos Desmond Wambi says this is typical of how President Museveni deals with potential political rivals, considered a viable threat to his nearly three-decade rule.
Museveni has always known this method of taking down his opponents with a lot of force, because opponents in Ugandan politics come out so open that you identify and attack you and finish you.
Mr. Mbabazi never appeared Sunday and instead arrived Monday to little fanfare. In reacting to a ban on his campaigning, Mr. Mbabazi said he does not need clearance from the police to do his work. He also promised to follow the letter of the law. Mr. Mbabazi announced on June 14th that he would seek the presidency, not the political opposition, but under the banner of the ruling National Resistance Movement Party, or NRM. It is the party that he and Mr. Museveni founded 30 years ago. Their collaboration came to an abrupt end when the president removed Mr. Mbabazi from both the government and the party. And ruling party politics are now at the heart of the ban against Mr. Mbabazi. On June 16th, Mr. Mbabazi sent a letter to the Electoral Commission introducing himself as an aspiring candidate without officially mentioning the NRM. He provided a schedule for public meetings around the country, which the commission approved. The NRM, however, stepped in, saying the party neither endorsed nor sponsored Mr. Mbabazi, and the Inspector General of Police sent a letter to Mr. Mbabazi stating that until he harmonized his party with the Election Commission, any public meetings would be unlawful. Mr. Mbabazi's lawyers remained defiant, arguing that because he did not declare he was running under the NRM and is technically just a presidential aspirant, meetings should remain legal. Crispy Kaheru, a coordinator with the Citizens Coalition for Electoral Democracy in Uganda, says the Electoral Commission should have handled the situation in a better way.
The Electoral Commission should have acted in response to his letter. He doesn't say that he's going to consult from within the NRM party structures. That was a tactical mistake from the Electoral Commission because the Electoral Commission assumed that he was going to consult on behalf of the NRM.
Campaigns for the general election will officially begin in mid-October. Until then, it remains to be seen if Mr. Mbabazi will be allowed to carry out nationwide consultations with his supporters. Elizabeth Pola for VOA News, Kampala, Uganda.
Today's Wednesday, July 1st, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Botte in Washington. Daybreak Africa time, 17 minutes past the hour. A 17-year-old boy has died from Ebola in Liberia just 7 weeks after the World Health Organization declared the country free of the deadly virus. As viewers Mariama Diallo reports, Liberian officials are trying to determine how the boy contracted the illness.
Deputy Health Minister Talbert Nienswa, who heads Liberia's Ebola response, told VOA the teenager died on June 24th and was given a safe burial the next day.
Our team was there yesterday,
he said, to investigate the situation and know the area. But to be vigilant is good. We were vigilant. Our surveillance team is working very well. They've picked up this dead child from his parents' home, tested him yesterday, and the child was positive. He says it's not known yet how the boy contracted the disease, but the case is under investigation. He stressed the public should not panic, noting that it's the only known case since the country was declared Ebola-free by WHO officials on May 9th.
Mangini County is responding.
Margibi County, he says, is responding and no need to panic. People hearing me, please lower your blood pressure. We are on top of this. The Ministry of Health, this is something we know how to deal with. But that message appears to be landing on deaf ears of a traumatized public. A resident of the affected community, Gbatim Success Nia, says memories of the thousands who died haunt him. He says he saw firsthand the impact it had on the survivors, and it's very scary to think that the virus is back.
I'm very afraid, and you know how difficult it was for some of our citizens who were business entrepreneurs, travel to a lot of countries, how difficult it was for them. People got stigmatized.
Mother of four children, Comfort Freeman, feels the same.
We the people can take precaution, but for children, for that matter, you can't take precaution. So I'm feeling so down this morning. I know indeed in God we trust that he can do anything possible.
The virus has killed more than 11,100 people since the outbreak began in late December 2013, hitting Liberia, Guinea, and Sierra Leone. Guinea declared a 3-week quarantine this month in a new effort to eradicate Ebola. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Dakar.
United States, Britain, and Sweden on Tuesday provided $8 million for the second phase of the Zimbabwe Works Project to provide technical, vocational, and entrepreneurial skills to 22,500 young people in the next 3 years. Erwin Chifera of VOA Zimbabwe Service reports from Harare.
This follows the successful completion of phase one of the project, which ran from 2012 to 2014 and benefited 8,600 young Zimbabweans. It was funded by the United States Agency for International Development, or USAID. The objective of the ZimWorks project is to improve the economic prospects of young people in 11 urban and rural districts nationwide. The program provides mentorship and internships opportunities for youth and business development services for job seekers. Zimbabwe USAID Mission Director Stefan Funk said, despite the challenges and difficulties the country faces, there is tremendous potential for young people in the country.
Young entrepreneurs are turning the wheels, and from where I stand, they are determined to build their own future. ZimWorks is here to support them in keeping that wheel turning and building the momentum.
ZimWorks Phase 1 beneficiary, 27-year-old Simbarashi Nyamadzawo, says without the training he received under the program, he would not be the successful motivational speaker, author, and employer he is today.
I've benefited in a huge way. It became a turning point in my life in the sense that it accelerated my progress. Just after the training program, I went on to implement the skills which I learned, which are mainly networking, persistence, and opportunity seeking. Within 6 weeks of that, I went on to do business with 7 people in my class. 6 months down the line, I had my first TV interview, and I began to gain relevance on radio, press.
Another beneficiary, 23-year-old banking and finance graduate Lisa Mashaka, has started a small catering company thanks to the ZimWorks project.
So I benefited exposure, networking, how to handle business, how to be an entrepreneur, how to manage your finances. Because I had initially stepped down, or not stepped down as such, but I initially stopped because of economic constraints. But now that I know how to manage, even in the economy, I have started again.
United Kingdom Department for International Development head in Zimbabwe, Annabel Gary, said, while young women are more likely to remain unemployed, the program would provide them with skills, confidence, and economic opportunities. Small and Medium Enterprises Minister Stanley Sonyoni commended the U.S., Britain, and Sweden for financing the program, which is being implemented at a time when the country is facing serious unemployment challenges. Reporting from Harare, this is Ivan Chifera.
Despite improving security in the last few years, Somalia remains one of the most dangerous countries to be a journalist, even more so for someone who cannot see. Abdulaziz Bello has the story of journalist Abdel Fattah Hassan Kalgaka, who has been reporting from the Somali capital for the last decade despite being blind.
Abdel Fattah Hassan, a visually impaired reporter, has defied the odds in a country ranked among the deadliest for journalists. He works at one of Mogadishu's leading radio stations. His friends and colleagues call him Kalgaal.
I had an eye illness at a very young age, but I couldn't get proper medical treatment due to the situation in Somalia. After the civil war started, I lost all hope of ever seeing again and had no medical support.
Despite the massive challenges, Kalgaal persevered and now works at Gobjok radio station as its senior reporter covering the Somali parliament. He also has a weekly program for handicapped people called The State of the Disabled. The live call-in show is popular, focusing on empowering the disabled by educating them on their basic rights.
I hope to use my position in the media to be a voice of the people and improve the humanitarian situation.
He hopes his message will resonate beyond Somalia's borders. Speaking 2 years ago at a technology, entertainment and design event, a global non-profit group to promote cultural understanding, Kalgaal described his journey from being born to a poor family in southern Somalia to becoming a husband, a father and journalist despite his visual impairment. He says that many people advised him against pursuing such a dangerous career, but he says it was his childhood dream, and being sightless doesn't make him any more or any less vulnerable than other journalists. The key, he said, to overcoming his challenges was a belief in himself, the support of his friends and family, and bosses willing to employ him for his skills and overlook his disability. Abdulaziz Bilal for VOA News, Mogadishu.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Wednesday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with basketball. The United States of America beat Egypt 92-50 as Australia outplayed Tunisia 93-64 at the Men's World Under-19 Basketball Championships in Heraklion, Greece on Tuesday. Today, Wednesday, marks the start of the knockout phase of the tournament, with teams vying for places in the quarterfinals. Egypt challenged Spain, while Tunisia is up against hosts Greece. In rugby, Zimbabwe hosts Tunisia in a Confederation of African Rugby Division 1A Africa Cup tie on Saturday. The touring Tunisians seek to bounce back after suffering a heavy 46-15 loss to Kenya in Nairobi over the weekend. In handball, African champions Angola are drawn in Group B with Cuba, China, the Netherlands, Poland, and Sweden in the preliminaries at the World Women's Handball Championships due in Denmark in December. According to the draws in Kolingas, Denmark, Tunisia are in Group A with Hungary, Japan, Montenegro, Serbia, and Denmark. The Democratic Republic of Congo is in Group C, along with Argentina, Brazil, France, Germany, and South Korea. Turning to football, Mauritania dismissed visitors Sierra Leone 2-0 in the return leg of their Orange African Nations Championship qualifier in Nouakchott. Mauritania progressed to the next stage of the contest courtesy of a 4-1 aggregate. Finally, Tunisia has parted ways with their Belgian coach, George Leekens, the Tunisia Football Federation revealed in the capital, Tunis. The surprise decision comes less than a week before Tunisia played Djibouti in the return leg of their Orange African Nations Championship tie. Leekens led Tunisia to an 8-1 triumph over Djibouti in the first leg. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. Here's our listener mail for this Wednesday morning, July 1st.
Good morning, Daybreak Africa. As Nigerian Revenue Mobilization Allocation and Fiscal Commission is currently on pressure to reduce the remuneration of Nigerian legislators, who are the highest paid legislators in the world, as well as other political office holders, I wish to use your medium and call on the body to use its constitutional power to remove the allowances that are always accrued to the unconstitutional Nigerian First Lady, Albert Alagbo, from the Department of Public Administration in Akanibi and Federal Polytechnic, Ebonyi State, Nigeria. Thank you.
We thank you, listener, for your comment, and please send your viewpoints to DaybreakAfrica at voanews.com. Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. A visibly angry Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi has vowed to strengthen anti-terrorism laws and blamed the country's outlaw Muslim Brotherhood for the assassination of the country's top prosecutor. That's it for this Wednesday, July 1st edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Mark Ouman, along with our engineer Jim Harriman, I'm James Butterson. Have a lovely day.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa, in the past 20 years, 18 African nations have been ravaged by war. Tens of millions of people have been victims of violence. Next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC, Straight Talk Africa's Shaka Sali and his guests will take a closer look at the effects of PTSD for survivors of conflict and war. That's next time on VOA Africa.
Hello, sports fans. This is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports. Please join me Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. And on Fridays, you can also hear my 30-minute show at 17:30 UTC. On the internet, like me on Facebook, follow me on Twitter, and read my blog. Check voaafrica.com for the addresses and enjoy the show.